No, it's got a mic headphones.
I have three names there. The first is R.H. Kennett. If you look at your bibliography, page 2, two-thirds of the way down, you see R.H. Kennett, Deuteronomy and the Decalogue, Cambridge Press, 1920. So Kennett wrote that book in 1920. He proposed a date for Deuteronomy in the time of Haggai and Zechariah. And said it could not have been written under either Hezekiah or Manasseh or Josiah. And some of the reasons he advocated were, he said, to gather all Israel together annually to one sanctuary would have been impracticable in the time of Hezekiah, Manasseh, or Josiah. The requirement that all Israel go to the central sanctuary, you know, centralization of worship, the one sanctuary for the annual feast, he says that would have been impractical in those earlier times. In the time of Haggai and Zechariah, after return from exile, when there was a relatively small community, it might have been workable, he said. He says any attempt to carry out the laws of Deuteronomy 13 would have meant civil war. Deuteronomy 13 concerns false worshipers. And earlier in Israel's history, what he's saying is there were so many people doing that that it simply would have been impractical to try to enforce that. Notice Deuteronomy 13 says, if a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder he has spoken takes place, and he says, let us follow other gods, let us worship them, you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. And verse 5 says, that prophet or dreamer must be put to death. Verse 6 says, if your own brother or your own daughter or your wife you love or your closest friend secretly entices you, saying, let us go worship other gods, show him no pity. Do not spare him or shield him. You must certainly put him to death. So that strict penalty for false teaching, false prophets, he says that it simply couldn't have been enforced in the time of Hezekiah, Manasseh, or Josiah. Chapter 17, which is the law of the king, the latter part of the chapter, he says, could not have been written when a king was on the throne, but only, quote, when there is a probability that one would be elected. In other words, it looks like a time when kingship is to be established, not like a time where it already is established. If you're in time of Hezekiah and Josiah, it's already established. You go to the post-exilic period when they come back with the governor, they're hoping for a return maybe to kingship, but he felt it would fit better there. He says, there is no king, but there's a probability that one will be elected. And strange to say, it is necessary to insist that the king who may be elected by the community generally should be of Israelite birth. You know, the law of the king says verse 15, do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother of Israel. So those were reasons he gave why it doesn't fit too well in the 600s and wants to push it later, the post-exilic time. I think the immediate question to a view like Kennett's is, why go to post-exilic time? Why not go to pre-monarchic times? See, that satisfies his objections, and of course satisfies the book of Deuteronomy as well. Alright, B is G. Holscher, H-O-L-S-C-H-E-R, also on page 2 of your bibliography. It's a German work, Composition and Origin of Deuteronomy, 1922. Holscher's thesis was that because of the detailed description of 2 Kings 22, you cannot deny the historicity of 2 Kings 22. It seems to be very detailed and represent itself as really describing what happened. But he did deny that the law book of Josiah could be identified with Deuteronomy. That was his book. He denied that the law book of Josiah could be identified with Deuteronomy. And in Holscher's view, Deuteronomy represented a program for restoration of Israel after the exile. He felt it came from the priestly circles in Jerusalem and dated it at about 500 B.C. Among his arguments were, he said it fits better in post-exilic time than pre, much as Kenneth was saying. He also said that Deuteronomy 16, requiring the whole family go to Jerusalem, was inoperable in pre-exilic time. And to quote from him, he says, oh no, this is from J. Thompson, speaking of Holscher. J. Thompson says, he proposed that Deuteronomy was not a program for reform, but the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. The wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. He also said that it's unlikely that Josiah would proclaim Deuteronomy 17:14 as the law of the land when it restricted the rights of the king. In other words, back to that law of the king, certain limitations put on what a king could do. He said, why would a king tie his own hands? He says from the Elephantine papyri, those are papyri found in Egypt in the 5th century B.C., dating from the 5th century B.C., he says it seems that they were unacquainted with the idea of centralization of worship because they had their own center of worship there. In fact, they were asking people of Jerusalem to help support the building of the temple there in that area of Egypt. And his idea is then that Deuteronomy, with its centralization emphasis, hadn't been promulgated yet. Because the Elephantine people seemed to be unacquainted with the demands of Deuteronomy. When was it? 5th century B.C. So he would be, I don't know if he came up with a precise date, but he would be fairly late in the post-exilic period for Duke. Yes?
Did you say that the Elephantine papyri showed that they were acquainted?
He claims that the fact that they had a place of worship there and were even soliciting funds for the building of the temple shows they had no idea of the centralization idea. And therefore, you see, he's saying Deuteronomy didn't exist. Of course, you could equally say Deuteronomy was Mosaic and these people long since forgotten it or ignored it. So. Yes? Just the practicality of it.
Well, is that really much of an argument in light of just that you have to be carefully or the idea of a human very idea of Israel, I think,
may be one way to go. The other thing is it says all the males. So it's not that everybody in Israel had to go to Jerusalem, but the head of the household is maybe the head of a clan or something like that, which then again would get more of a representative kind of thing. All right, that's in general, just briefly, the idea of Holscher. His view was attacked by Patton in that article I mentioned earlier. It's page 3 of your bibliography. And JBL 1928, The Case for the Post-Exilic Origin of Deuteronomy. You see there he is examining Holscher's case. And what Patton does is argue for the traditional Wellhausian standpoint. And he does that with a number of arguments, that is Patton, arguing for the Wellhausian standpoint over against Holscher, criticizing Holscher. First, he emphasizes that the measures taken by Josiah in 2 Kings 22 conform to the requirements of Deuteronomy. In other words, if you compare what Josiah did in his reformation, in 2 Kings 22 and 23, he argues that those things conform to the requirements of Deuteronomy. I don't have a lot of problem with that. I think you can draw a certain connection between Deuteronomy and what Josiah did. Secondly, Patton says the historical trustworthiness of 2 Kings 22 cannot be questioned. Again, that's interesting to me. And I'll quote from him. He says, what the editor of Kings wrote out of his own head about the times of David and Solomon, perhaps even about the times of Hezekiah, may well be literary invention. But the days of Josiah were too near and too clear in the memory of his contemporaries for him to make up the story out of whole cloth. So again, you see, you get that interesting twist where he's arguing for historical reliability with the Josiah story, where he's admitting the David story, the Solomon story, maybe even Hezekiah story are fabrications.
Now, would Holscher agree with his view that
he said that 2 Kings 22... was generally reliable, but it had some later additions. Some later additions. Generally, he would say it's reliable, but with some later additions. All right, that's my next point. Patton criticized Holscher's view that 2 Kings 23, 8a, 9 to 10, 15, 21 to 27 were later additions after 500. He criticized Holscher's view that 2 Kings 23, 8a, 9 to 10, 15, 21 to 27 were later additions after 500. Holscher would say it's generally reliable, but there are these later additions, and Patton criticizes him for that. 23, 8a, 9 to 10, 15, 21 to 27. See, Patton says, Holscher begins by eliminating a number of verses in these chapters as interpolations by redactor D2, the very latest editor of the Book of Kings, and so forth. Holscher's main argument for rejecting 23, 8a is, and 9 to 10, is that they interrupt the context. So I won't go into the details of that, but you get that debate between these two. Let me just mention here, Holscher's view of Josiah was not a person who centralized worship so much as a person who purified. Not that he centralized worship, but he purified it. And you see, for that, no knowledge of Deuteronomy is required. If Deuteronomy is what centralized worship, and that's late, then Josiah's Reformation, in Holscher's view, was purification of worship, not centralization of worship. The way Jeremiah was treated and the lack of response among the people to his message would indicate whatever went on in Josiah's reform, it was not something that turned the whole nation around and continued. There's somewhat of a mystery there. It's exactly what the connection of Jeremiah, the prophet, is to Josiah's reform, because Jeremiah is not mentioned in Kings' connection with Josiah's reform, and Jeremiah doesn't mention in Jeremiah Josiah's reform. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean there's any problem here, but it's just that you don't know exactly how Jeremiah was involved in the implementation of some of those reforms or what his role was. It's just not addressed. But what you're saying, I think, is true. It doesn't seem like the Reformation was one that was of such significance in depth and in duration that it turned the nation back. That Jeremiah, you know, his prophecies, or his warnings and his calls of the people to return to the Lord fell on deaf ears. They about killed him. That was found in the temple in the time of Josiah? I'm not sure, but I assume he would think it was one of these, maybe the Covenant Code or some other part of the Pentateuch. Wait a minute, let me see. What does he say? I'm not sure. As far as that elephantine argument, no, that was one of his arguments, that they don't have any knowledge of this centralization thing. Patton says that just shows that after Josiah's Reformation, illegitimate cultic practices returned quickly. The argument that centralization of worship was impractical in the time of Josiah, Patton counters by saying it was also impractical in the post-exilic period. So, you know, he just says that doesn't help. He says, even granting, that is, this is Patton, even granting the impractical idealism of Deuteronomy, one cannot help asking whether this idealism was any more impractical in post-exilic time than in pre-exilic time. Okay, G.R. Berry, that's the C on your sheet. Here's the answer to that question that Mr. Hedge asked. Holscher made no attempt to discover the law book of Josiah elsewhere in the Old Testament. He didn't try to identify it. So, you know, he's saying it wasn't Deuteronomy because Deuteronomy was later, but he didn't attempt to do it. Now, what Berry did, Berry came along and made some suggestions in respect to that. He also felt Deuteronomy was post-exilic, but then he developed the thesis that the law book of Josiah is to be identified with that holiness code, H, which is pretty much composed of Leviticus 17 to 26. His article is on your bibliography, page 2, G.R. Berry, Date of Deuteronomy, JBL 1940. And his proposal then is that H precedes Deuteronomy rather than following. H precedes Deuteronomy rather than following. 17 to 26. And he said the connections between Deuteronomy and that holiness code are to be ascribed to the influence of H on D rather than vice versa, the influence of D on H. So you just turn it around. So he came to a conclusion for a late date for Deuteronomy and suggests that perhaps the law book of Ezra was Deuteronomy. You know, when Ezra read the book of the law and hearing the people in the great time. But that maybe it was Deuteronomy. Now the view of Barry, we won't get into these details, but the view of Barry was opposed by a man named Freed. I thought that was on your sheet, but it's not. The view of Barry was opposed by A. Freed, the code spoken of in 2 Kings 22 and 23 in Journal of Biblical Literature, Volume 40, 1921. I won't go further into details of that. But those are three representative advocates of a post-exilic date. So you see, get back to where, just get the overview, we can get lost in the trees here. This Deuteronomy is the keystone for this JDP thing. If there's a question about the date of Deuteronomy, then it affects your whole theory. Well, there have been a number, and I've just given you three examples, critical scholars that say it ought to be moved later. So it's not so absolutely established, even among critical scholars, as you might think. But then let's go back. Advocates of a date earlier than 621, that's two. But during the monarchical period, I've got two, four, five names there. Ewald, Westphal, Oestreicher, Welch, and von Rod. Heinrich Ewald placed the origin in the time of Manasseh. That's not much earlier, just a little bit earlier. Manasseh. Ewald was in the late 1800s, right, at the same time as well. A. Westphal. Wrote a book called The Law and the Prophets in 1910 and said that only Deuteronomy could have inspired a reformation like that of Hezekiah. So he felt that Deuteronomy originated during the time of Hezekiah. And Isaiah, remember Isaiah prophesied during the time of Hezekiah. So that was an appropriate period, he thought, for the composition of a book like Deuteronomy. So with Ewald, you go back to Manasseh, Westphal back to Hezekiah. T.H. Oestreicher, the third man there, perhaps Oestreicher and Welch. Well, Oestreicher, Welch, and von Rod are probably the three most important under this heading. Oestreicher argued for a date earlier than Hezekiah. He'd go back to about the 10th century. And in connection with his view, he said that the Reformation of Josiah accomplished purification of worship, but not centralization. The Reformation of Josiah accomplished purification, but not centralization. Deuteronomy does not require centralization of worship. Now, I say that's of significance because it really undermines this whole structure of well housing if Deuteronomy doesn't require centralization of worship. He spoke, to use two German terms, he says that the Reformation of Josiah sought cultus Einheit, not cultus Reinheit. Centralization of worship, but purification of worship. And he felt that Josiah's Reformation had a strong political character to it. He feels that what Josiah was trying to do was free Israel, both politically and religiously, from Assyrian dominance. He said all these things that Josiah did had nothing to do with centralization of the cult. It was more, he had certain political goals in connection with freeing Israel from Assyrian domination, and what he wanted to do was achieve that political independence, but not centralization of worship. He says, Deuteronomy does not direct itself against multiplicity of sanctuaries, but against polytheism. And, of course, the Assyrians were polytheists. And that's the issue. Now, we'll come back to that issue in more detail later, because Oestreicher argued that the phrase in Deuteronomy that says in Deuteronomy 12:14 is one of the key, there are several places that it occurs, but in 12:14 where it says, in the place which the Lord your God shall choose in one of thy tribes, he says that's better translated, in any place which the Lord shall choose in any of your tribes. We have to look at that because that's a key issue to how to translate those phrases. But that's where he says that Deuteronomy 12 does not demand centralization of worship. So there could be multiplicity of sanctuaries, but what Deuteronomy opposed was heathen cults, polytheism, and arbitrary choosing of places for worship. All right, Adam Welch is D. Look on your sheet. I think I have at top of page 4, Code of Deuteronomy 1924. Welch came pretty much to the same conclusion as Oestreicher concerning the question of centralization of worship. He regarded the basic emphasis of Deuteronomy to be on the character of the places of worship, not on the number. He concluded the book originated in northern Israel from the time of Samuel on. See, that's fairly early, even pre-monarchy. But that in its present form, it dates from about the 8th century. So with Ewald, Westphal, Oestreicher, Welch, and I haven't mentioned Von Rad yet, But with all those men, you're moving back earlier, progressively earlier than the time of Josiah, but not back all the way to pre-monarchical time. All right, with von Rod, you have the influence of form critical study coming into his viewpoint. And his viewpoint is rather complex. There are three books that are significant. Let's see if I have them on your sheet. I have one of them on your sheet, middle of page 3. Studies in Deuteronomy. That's this little book published in 1953. But he also did a commentary on Deuteronomy, which has been translated in the Old Testament Library series published by Westminster Press. That is 1964, first published in English in 1966. And then also important is his article, The Problem of the Hexateuch, which is in this volume of collected essays. Problem of the Hexateuch, which was originally published in 38, but this collection of essays was published in 66. So those three books are important as far as von Rod's view of Deuteronomy and its date and its nature and so forth. He retains the idea that Deuteronomy is the law book of Josiah. But, he says, Deuteronomy is the result of a long and complicated process of development. In other words, it's not something that was just written in the time of Josiah. It's the end product of a long process of development. Page 37 of his Studies in Deuteronomy. He says, Deuteronomy makes its appearance at a definite point in the history of Israel's faith. It makes its appearance as a finished, mature, beautifully proportioned, theologically clear work. Because of these characteristics, it is in all circumstances to be taken as, in one respect, the final product of a long and extremely complex development. At a relatively late date, it gathers together practically the whole of the assets of the faith of Israel, re-sifting them and purifying them theologically. The most varied groups of traditions are harmonized to one another in it and welded together into as complete and perfect unity as can be conceived. In this respect, as in others, it is comparable to John's Gospel and the New Testament books. That's also assuming there's long development between the, behind the Gospel of John in its present form. But that's his view as far as the character of the book. He gets more specific. He says that that Deuteronomy is the product of a restoration movement in which the old cultic tradition of the Yahweh of Amphictyony at Shechem is reintroduced as obligatory upon Israel. Did you ever hear that term Amphictyony? Amphictyony. He says this is a restoration movement in which the old cultic tradition of the Yahweh Amphictyony at Shechem is reintroduced as obligatory on Israel. Now, an amphictyony is a confederation of political units around the central religious shrine. Confederation of political units around the central religious shrine. I think the term and concept is borrowed from Greek history. But there's long been a theory, von Rauch was one advocate on it, Martin Oak was another, that the original organization of Israel was an amphictyony, and the center of it was Shechem. Remember in Joshua 24, Joshua calls all Israel to Shechem. And the covenant is renewed
at that assembly. Joshua challenges them to serve the Lord and says, "Me, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord," and so forth. People like Noah and Bonrad feel that right at that point in Israel's history, you had a lot of diverse groups coming together and adopting Yahweh as their deity and depicting it as far as social structure. A lot of diverse groups, but around the central religious shrine. So what he's saying here is Deuteronomy is the product of a restoration movement in which the old cultic tradition of Yahweh and Fictiny at Shechem is reintroduced as obligatory upon Israel. What he tried to do then was to apply the form critical method to the book of Deuteronomy to break out of all this stalemate and debate about the character of the book and so forth. And the structure of the book then was something that particularly attracted his attention. If you look in his problem of the Hexateuch article, he says, page 26, "In the light of what has been said, we must look now again at the book of Deuteronomy. We may leave aside the many difficulties currently raised by the problem of Deuteronomy and confine ourselves to a matter which has yet scarcely been touched on by scholars, despite all the controversy about the nature of this book. What are we to say about the form of Deuteronomy?" So Von Rod starts asking the question, what do we do with the form, the structure of the book as a whole, with its remarkable succession of speeches, laws, and so on? Even if it be thought that Deuteronomy in its present guise comes straight from the theologian's desk, this does not prevent our asking to what genre it belongs. It simply drives the question further back, compels us to look into the history and development of the form of the material used by the Deuteronomic theologians. One cannot accept the assumption that these men created ad hoc so remarkable a literary form. And he goes on and discusses this at some length. He says, I won't read it all, but he says, obviously, from the point of view of form criticism, no one would accept any such picture of the origins of Deuteronomy. It is precluded by a recognition of the fact that Deuteronomy is, in form, an organic whole. In form, he says, it's an organic whole. We may distinguish any number of different strata and accretions by literary criteria, but in the matter of form, the various constituents form an indivisible unity. The question is thus inescapably raised of the origin and purpose of the form of Deuteronomy, as we now have it. And he then gives an outline of the structure of the book. Now, we're going to look at the structure and form of Deuteronomy later. I think it's really significant that Von Rod says it's really important to see the unity of the structure of the whole book of Deuteronomy. He sees it as the end product of a long process of development, but he sees the structure of it as rooted back in this covenant renewal festival that was held periodically in Shechem. He feels it reflects the elements of that covenant renewal cultic liturgy, you might say. He then proposes, see, this is way back early, time of Joshua. How was that form preserved? How was it passed on? It's rooted back in this cultic observance of Shechem. He proposes it was the Levites who preserved and elaborated on that old cultic material. The Levites. So the final form then is to be attributed to the Levites who preached and taught the law during the monarchical period. On page 26 of his commentary, his conclusion is, "If these considerations are well grounded, we shall suppose
one of the sanctuaries of northern Israel, probably Shechem or Bethel, to be Deuteronomy's place of origin, and the century before 621 must be its date. There's no sufficient reason for going back further. Century before 621. Now, what he's saying is, it's here 621. Deuteronomy had a long process of development, but it came to its final form at, say, 721, century before 621. But it's rooted back in this Yahweh fiction, and it's been developed over a period of time. Final form as we know it would have been about a century before 621. Now, I want to come back to the form of the book. That becomes increasingly important. But for the present, you got some idea of what von Rad's approach to the question was. Now, three, very quickly. Pre-monarchical dating but non-Mosaic. Two names, Edward Robertson and R. Brinker. Edward Robertson wrote The Old Testament Problem in 1950. And in that book, he says, the Hebrews entered Palestine as an organized community possessing a nucleus of law comprising the Decalogue and perhaps the Book of the Covenant. Between the settlement and the rise of the monarchy, this community became decentralized and split up into a number of religious communes, each with its own independent sanctuary. At these sanctuaries, there developed divergent, though related, traditions and laws. When the people were reunited under a king, it was necessary to bring about religious unity. For this purpose, a summary of legislation comprising a codification after due investigation and review of the law codes of the sanctuaries was prepared under Samuel's guidance and immediate supervision. This new code was the Book of Deuteronomy and was designed to be the standard law book of the centralized administration, the union of tribes under a king made centralization of worship desirable and possible. So that's a very interesting theory. Very hypothetical. You see the general thesis is that Israel just had a government told to moral the Ten Commandments, and then as they settled down the land, had all kinds of different law traditions developed. Under Samuel's leadership, Samuel's the one who anointed the first two kings, Saul and David, those traditions were unified, and the result of that unification of all these diverse traditions was the Book of Deuteronomy, so he would ascribe it to the work of Samuel. So it's pre-monarchy, but non-Mosaic, and very hypothetical. R. Brinker, B., The Influence of Sanctuaries in Early Israel, was his writing, 1946. A position very similar to Robertson, but argued that centralization was not stressed, rather purification. So you see, you're back to that twist. Same thing that Holscher talked about. Does Deuteronomy really require centralization, or is its emphasis more purification? And he took a position similar to Robertson, that Samuel was really responsible, but that centralization is not stressed. The stress is warning against syncretism with idolatry and purity of worship. All right, that brings us to four. And I think I'll stop. It's 10 of. I want to just say, I'm not going to say a whole lot about any of these people. I want to make a few comments about some of them. The advocates for a Mosaic date. As I mentioned earlier, through this whole history of discussion, there's always been those representing a position that argues for a Mosaic date. And these are some representatives of that. And there's some current people who are presently involved in this debate and really bringing new perspectives on the debate that help to substantiate a Mosaic position for the origin of Judah. So if you want to move into that later, yeah.
And Fictiony is an association of political units around a central religious shrine. Central religious shrine. Or deity. So the idea applying that to Israel is, from these critical perspectives, is that you had, see, that most of these guys would say that Israel didn't come as a block out of Egypt and come up and occupy the land, but there may have been some small element that did that, but then you had a lot of other diverse elements, and all these elements pulled together around the sanctuary at Shechem with the deity Yahweh and said, the Lord will be our God, and that's what pulled them together, not their ethnic background. Okay. Okay, see you next week.